When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS-certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made-safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style, and a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of, 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
When the body doesn't feel safe, the mind will tell stories to match. Welcome back to It Old Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I have a little bit of a cold if I sound a little bit nasally. I am a recovering alcoholic. I am an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I'm a cat mom. I am a condiment lover. I wash my feet every night before I go to bed. I have a potty mouth. I'm an acquired taste. And this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up a whole hell of a lot more than you initially thought that it did. So for any of you who may not know, I am currently on a little hiatus, but I'm going to be back pretty soon, folks. I'm coming back pretty soon. But in the meantime, we are going back into the adult child vault. And boy, do I have a banger for you today. We are taking a re-listen to my episode with Carmen Dominguez, who has probably more years of experience than I do on living on this earth. She is a psychotherapist. She is the chief clinical advisor for the Integrative Life Center. And if you have ever wondered why you feel so damn uncomfortable when things in your life are going well, or why you keep abandoning yourself in relationships, or why nothing seems to stick in your healing, this episode explains why. And Carmen breaks down the nervous system in a way most therapists do not. She will help you understand what the polyvagal theory actually looks like in real life, and basically how dysregulation drives everything. Addiction, trauma bonding, people pleasing, your inability to rest, to sit still. And understanding the polyvagal theory for us shit shows, for us trauma survivors, is so damn important because it explains why you feel unsafe in safe situations and why your nervous system, your body reacts the way that it does, even when nothing is wrong. Story of my life. How about you? And the polyvagal theory really helps us to see that our reactions are not personality flaws or indicative of us being broken, but rather, you know, these pattern responses from a nervous system that is doing its damnedest, its best to try to protect us. Quick primer before we go into this episode to help you really grasp, comprehend, understand what Carmen is going to be saying regarding polyvagal theory. I think it's helpful for you to understand that there are three core states of your autonomic nervous system. So number one, we have the ventral vagal state. So this is when you feel calm, safe, connected. Number two, you have the sympathetic state. So this is when you are in fight-flight mode. So when you are anxious, panicky, when you feel that sense of urgency, story of my life. And then the third state is the dorsal vagal state. And so this is when you are in freeze or shutdown modes, when you are numb, when you are hopeless, when you are checked out. And it's important to note here that the goal is not to stay calm all the time, but that would be nice, wouldn't it? But rather, it is all about building the ability, the capacity to move between these states without getting stuck in one of them. That is what regulation is. Regulation is not always being calm, but it's about not getting stuck in one of these states. So let's get on with the damn show, folks. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to Dan the Join Shit Show, my online support community, where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly support groups, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal, where you can feel less alone. Where you can feel seen, heard, and understood like never before. You can access this community either on your computer or on an app on your phone. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. This is where you will gain insights into yourself in a way that is very non-threatening, because you're hearing other people, you're hearing their experience, and this allows you to gain insight in yourself and say, oh, actually that resonates, or huh, I think what they're talking about, that explains me, as opposed to your therapist or whoever, like trying to point something out to you. And I think that's why it's so damn important to be a part of a peer support community. There are just aspects of healing that you can only gain by being amongst others who are doing this same damn work of healing, of breaking the cycle, which is no easy feat, okay? So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for fucking ever, how about you do it today for less than $1 a day? Go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see the link in the show notes. Do it. Yes, just do it. You can quit after a month already, okay? Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod, and last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. This really helps me reach more suffering shit shows. Thank you. Love you all.
Well, guys, it is my pleasure to introduce Carmen Dominguez. She is the executive clinical director of Integrative Life Center. Howdy ho.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Of course. So I've just done some mild stalking on you. Later on, I want to get into your personal story, but a few questions I was thinking about. So I was inpatient, I guess, 3 different times. The last time I was inpatient was in 2008. I do not remember, and I went to good places. I don't remember trauma ever coming up. What are your thoughts? I have mixed feelings about this. So there's a part of me that thinks that somebody needs to kind of get control of the substance abuse issues and kind of get some solid sobriety there before they're really in a place where they can start confronting those deeper issues and the deeper trauma. But then there's another part of me that feels like part of the reason that a lot of people can't stay sober is because they're not addressing the trauma. So if someone's coming into, you know, residential treatment and they're, you know, an active addiction, they're getting sober, what is your thoughts as far as like how deep does one go in such the early stages of when you're trying to just get that physical sobriety?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would say that we would want to be intentional about how to bring client in to the journey of healing. And the first, I would say, phase of healing has to do with establishing a sense of safety within their own being. That's really important. What you're talking about speaks to how challenging it is to really treat the trauma, if you will, the trauma wound, when you're in a state that is dysregulated. So the first phase of treatment is really to orient clients who come to see us to the way that we understand the healing journey. You know, that there's many ways to heal trauma, but if you consider that there's one destination, perhaps, and that one destination, first and foremost, is to establish a sense of safety within themselves. And, you know, that starts with really orient them to our culture and the way we see it, the way we see healing. The healing journey really starts with recovering your sense of inherent worth that has been lost in your attempt to survive, because we're wired for safety and connection. So right from the get-go, humans get busy scanning the environment to establish a sense of safety first. You know, we need safety and connection, but safety usually overrides the connection, and we develop patterns to keep us safe. And so when a client first comes into ILC, we really want to, you know, shed light on that process, that the first step really is to recover their inherent worth and their sense of safety.
But isn't that like a lifelong journey?
It is certainly a lifetime journey. It is. It's ongoing, because, you know, we can find our sense of inherent worth. We can find our sense of safety, and then we can lose it in a nanosecond when something happens in the environment that triggers us in some way. The difference is that when we are living consciously, when we're living with the awareness that safe, you know, that first is establishing safety within ourselves, so that then we can look at what's in front of us that's challenging, that's triggering us, and address it from a place of safety, because we don't really come from a place of safety in the, you know, when we first enter treatment. And even after we've left treatment, we get dysregulated. Things happen and we get dysregulated. I would say that, you know, it's nuanced here, in that this journey back to your inherent worth is nuanced, because there's like this, also this phobia that we have with going inside. There's a phobia that we have with, you know, really finding like that, you know, that witness self that's available, I believe, to all of us. There's a phobia because we have spent our life giving our faith and loyalty to whether it's a substance, whether it's a love object, whether it's the anger. We have given our faith and loyalty to certain ways of being, certain states of getting, you know, certain states that drugs get us into, as this is what's going to, you know, this is what it is that makes me feel okay. This is what makes me feel safe. Mm-hmm. So to reorient somebody back to their inherent worth in and of itself is challenging and is the first phase of treatment. We can't really process trauma, if you will, if we're not feeling safe, because then we are like re-traumatizing ourselves, our system. You know, we are re-traumatizing our whole system. So yes, it is a lifetime journey. And I think on the path of that journey, we get derailed, you know, on a regular basis. But the more that we practice coming back in alignment with, you know, our inherent worth, with what, you know, one of the ways that we work here is using the polyvagal theory that really speaks into how to get into a ventral state. The more that we practice having a ventral break and coming into alignment with our witness self, with our, you know, bringing our prefrontal cortex online, the more that we do that, the better that we are at disentangling from patterns that served us in our journey, served us to protect us from the woundedness that we don't know how to, tolerate. We don't know how to embrace and integrate and digest. The more that we come back in, the more that we're prepared to look at that in a state of safety versus in a state of dysregulation that doesn't really do much. So the more that we come back, the more that we practice coming back into a ventral state, into a state of, you know, that witness self that we call here at ILC, the the more that we know how to have self-agency. And who's driving the bus? You know, is it our parts, the parts of us that are dysregulated? Is it the parts of us that have given our faith and loyalty to addictions? Or is it the part that, you know, from my perspective, my clinical perspective, it really is resourced and has a greater, wider perspective of what's happening in the here and now? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's actually something that I don't know that much about. And I've had a listener ask if I could have somebody on to talk about it, but that the whole polyvagal nerve, that's something that I've read a little bit about. But I would love to, if you could expand more into that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I'll just speak into it briefly because it can get quite complicated, but
yeah, I would imagine
is that, you know, we have, you know, the autonomic system has, you know, the parasympathetic state, the sympathetic state, and the ventral nerve state, which is the one that allows us to feel a sense of calm and connection with our whole system in such a way that, simply put, our prefrontal cortex, that is the part of the brain that really allows us to see things from, see what's in front of us with a wider lens, that has the capacity to have compassion, to have clarity, to, you know, see things generally, you know, simply put, from a wider lens, not from a distorted version of in front of us. And then we have, you know, when we get into sympathetic, that's when we hear about fight, flight, or freeze, you know, or fight or flight, I should say. And when we are in a dysregulated sympathetic state, we, you know, feel anxious, we feel panicked, we feel rageful, we feel like dysregulated in kind of a very mobilized, energized way. And then there's the parasympathetic, you know, we get into a dorsal kind of parasympathetic state, we are, you know, collapsed, if you will. We're in that free state. We're in like, oh, I can't move. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Porges discovered this, if you will. I want to say he discovered it in that he was looking at babies and what makes some certain babies more resilient than others. Uh-huh. And babies who have the ventral vagus nerve tone are more resilient. And if you consider that, they're more, what I find fascinating is,
what do you mean by that? The tone.
The tone is like, well, it's such a great question. It's when we have vagus tone, like we can be in the state, like we can hold that state longer. We can hold the state of connection, of our system being connected, our heart being, the organ of the heart being connected with other organisms in our being that allows us to breathe, you know, in such a way that gives the message to the body, to our autonomic system, that you're safe. It gives the message that we're safe.
And is that something that can be seen like on a brain scan if it's toned, if it's in tone?
Well, what you can see is that the way that you're breathing and your heart and the rhythm of your heart is operating in a way that is, you know, there's a flow, there's a sense of like all your organs are connected. The rhythm of your heart is running with the, you know, the rhythm of your breath, and you're giving your body and your brain is getting the message, I'm okay. Everything's all right. And when we know that everything's okay, when the message of the body and the mind and the energetics that run through us are getting the message that you're okay, what happens is that the prefrontal cortex comes online and we can then see things from a wider lens. Mm-hmm. We can't see things from a wider lens when we are, you know, interpreting or perceiving, better put, the world from a dysregulated state. We're seeing it through the lens of traumatic experiences that we've had that resemble the current situation in some way. Mm-hmm. Yet the current situation is not really calling for us to have to run or fight.
If it's hysterical, it's historical.
Yes, 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 yes. And so, you know, I would say that what's important to know of the polyvagal theory simply is that it really speaks to our autonomic system that's functioning on automatic pilot. Mm-hmm. And when something in the environment triggers a state of threat, some of us will go into sympathetic dysregulation, which is a mobilization of like fight or flight. Let me fix this. Let me make this okay. Or I'm going to collapse and I'm going to play dead. I mean, really, I mean, when you think of animals, they play dead and they're not really dead, but they're playing dead so that the perpetrator in their environment leaves them alone. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of, you know, this in action. During the pandemic, I was on my deck outside in my house, and this bird, I was with my granddaughter and my daughters that were there, and this little bird came and hit the window, and it looked to all of us that he had died, and he just collapsed. Mm. And we were all, you know, just surrounding him and, you know, loving him. Like, really, I mean, it was kind of this moment where my granddaughter was saying, oh, like, let's just send him loving energy. I mean, really, that sounds kind of like trippy, but that's what we were doing. And the little bird, you know, all of a sudden came to life and flew away. Mm. And we're like, wait a minute, what just happened? And that really reflects our autonomic system. Mm. That in humans, that when we are in a state that feels like such a threat, that our, you know, everyone's autonomic system operates differently. You know, some people might get into fight or flight like automatically and quickly and stay there, not for an hour, but for days. Like, they're in states of
been there.
Right.
In a relationship I've been in.
Right. So it's like a hyper aroused state of fight or flight. Mm. And then there's, you know, some folks who get stimulated and it triggers their trauma in their system that it's not been processed. Mm-hmm. And they go automatically into a collapse. Mm-hmm. And that's when we see people in a depressive state, a hopeless state. And so what's also important in understanding the polyvagal theory is that both the sympathetic and the parasympathetic states are necessary. Mm-hmm. For our survival, and not in all ways, because when you get up in the morning, when you were sleeping at night, you were in a state of rest and restoration, like you were into rest, and so that you could repair and that you could digest and you could integrate what happened throughout the day. You know, that's happening automatically. You're resting. And when you get up in the morning, you feel mobilized. And if you've had good rest, then you can go out into the world and do your business and be excited, but not necessarily in a state of panic or in a state of like, you know, dysregulation that, you know, feels more like you're running, you know, to stand still, but you don't know where you're, like, you're just running. So both of those states, when they're regulated, are serving us. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to get in sympathetic. Mm-hmm. To get on the bike, to go on a bike ride, and mm-hmm. to feel like the awe of life. You know, you can't just be on the couch taking a nap and saying, I'm getting ready for the bike ride. You have to get off the couch. Yeah. And feel like I'm rested, I'm happy, I'm ready, I've eaten, and now I'm going to go. That's different than dragging yourself out of bed and then getting enough like sympathetic on board online, and you're still feeling dysregulated, but you go, I gotta go, I've got to do this. If I don't do this, I'm no good. So you see there that there's, when you have, and back to your question, you know, if you have, you know, ventral tone, it it really speaks to being able to hold within your system a state that allows the flow of your energy, of your being, to function in a way that allows you to see and the world and move in the world with curiosity, you know, with creativity, with compassion for yourself and for others. It puts you in a very different state. Now, the thing is that a lot of us don't feel safe in a ventral state. Isn't that, I mean, that's kind of interesting. You know, you probably have heard in the addiction world that some people, you know, become accustomed and familiar with chaos.
Well, that's what, I mean, one of the adult child traits is we become addicted to excitement. So yeah, we get addicted to those negative chemicals. So absolutely.
We get addicted. What becomes familiar, what we develop an appetite for, is being in states of dysregulated, you know, sympathetic or dysregulated, you know, dorsal. And that's what we're used to. You know, so if your body becomes accustomed to it, it's because we've been in those states for an ongoing period of time. And so it becomes habitual, it becomes automatic. And when we try to get into ventral, where for a moment, it almost feels like you're on vacation. And if you think of it, you're on vacation, it's really beautiful. You know, the sun is shining, you know, the air is, you know, there's a breeze, your feet are in the sand and everything seems really peaceful. But then your system goes, I don't really think I want to stay on this vacation anymore. I want to go home, even if home is chaotic. And even though home feels dysregulated, it's what you know. And sometimes that wins over, you know, the peace that we're looking for, because our system isn't, the way I see it is our system, the way I experience it and have seen it, is that our system doesn't hold that vibrational pattern of safety very well, because it doesn't have the tone, doesn't have the discipline. It's comfortable in some, you know, kind of strange way being dysregulated. It's familiar.
Well, yeah, it's like the same thing with like attachment theory, right? Like as an anxious attacher, if I go on a date with somebody who's secure, that's boring, right? Like I want that avoidant who's gonna, you know, rev those chemicals up for me. And that's why I would think that, you know, we get into this anxious avoidant trap.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you're saying, you know, in like object relation theory that sheds light on this perspective is like the repetition compulsion, you know, it's like where you felt held for a little while, you know, of whatever that was, you know, you were always trying to get to that. Mm-hmm. However, we also become really familiar to the state of when we get dropped, mm-hmm. and how we then try to get ourselves back into that state of being held. And so it becomes this repetition compulsion where we're just kind of running that cycle of, oh, I feel peaceful for a little bit. This is kind
doesn't
of
last long.
But you know what? The way I see it is I want to go back. Like your system is automatic and it's like, oh, this doesn't feel right. You know, I mean, a very simple way that I like to look, or that resonates with how I experience this with myself and with clients and, you know, the people I've worked with, is that, you know, you can get your piano tuned. And if it's been out of tune for a really long period of time, you have somebody come in and it gets tuned up and it's really, you know, operating beautifully and harmoniously. And then if someone doesn't take care of it regularly, it goes back in a way that, you know, it doesn't allow you to, you know, to play your piano optimally and beautifully and harmoniously.
I think about that from like the perspective of trauma. And I'm curious if you see it this way, you know, obviously with addiction, there's no such thing as, you know, being healed. It's a continual process. When it comes to complex trauma and complex PTSD, do you also see that as something that continually has to be, you know, addressed and treated?
Yes. And I would say, you know, I mean, in the language that I'd like to use, it's like when, you know, words have power. So if you think about having really identified as someone who's a victim of trauma, and you say, you know, if we tell people we're never going to get better, or it gets tricky. So what I would say is that it's an ongoing journey to live your life. It's a choice to live your life consciously. When we start, the thing about trauma that's really powerful, the healing of trauma, is that because we have to reconnect with ourselves in such a way that allows us to heal our whole system, to attend to the ways that the trauma response impacted our whole system, our body, our mind, our spirit, it requires us to be attuned and to bring our awareness inward, to bring our awareness to what needs our attention. And that means in many ways to get dominion of what you're giving your attention to, what you're giving your faith and loyalty to. Mm-hmm. And that is a constant, that's a commitment. That's a commitment to you. That's a commitment. Like if you think of a marriage, you can fall in love and it's all wow. But if you don't nourish the seeds of a healthy mm-hmm. connection, you will fall into old patterns. And that's the same as, entering treatment, at least from the ILC, vantage point of that journey back home to yourself, is that you're going to get distracted. Mm-hmm. And the thing that hopefully what's different when you leave ILC is that you know that you're going to get distracted, and that you then with grace and with self-compassion recommit to coming, to bring yourself back into a state of regulation, of ventral, of the witness. We call it the witness self here. We can, depending on who we're working with, because that might not resonate with everybody. But when I say the witness self, it resonates with my perspective. It's the one that's witnessing. It's who we are as awareness. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's very, similar to what we know about when you are an event, when you're in ventral, when your prefrontal cortex can come online and you can see things from a much larger perspective, and you can perceive things from not from the eyes of your adaptive survival, lens.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Absolutely. I think when I say it from the standpoint of, I don't want to say people can't ever be healed, but the thought that will never be triggered is unrealistic.
It's unrealistic.
Right? Yeah. And so it's about having coping skills. So do you view codependency as rooted in trauma?
Yes. I see codependency as a natural phenomenon of the human condition, because even if we look for a moment again at the polyvagal theory, there's another state called fawn.
Yep, fawning.
That to me is equal to codependency.
Codependency, absolutely.
In that when we land here as humans, consider that we're sensory beings, and when we're infants, we're just perceiving the world mm-hmm. without our ability to make up stories about it, but soon we're going to make up stories about it, and as we start making up stories about it, we start to develop a narrative mm-hmm. and that narrative is running our life. And the narrative has been formed in our need for safety and connection. So we're trying to figure out, well, what do they want from me? So that I'm okay. What do I need to do? How do I need to look? How do I need to move in the world so that I'm accepted, so that I'm part of? And so in that process, we're not checking in with ourselves, with our authentic self. We are vigilantly looking externally to get cues from the people that we need to take care of us to survive, to give us information about how we should be in the world. Who should we be in the world? So if you came from a family where they said everybody who has PhDs has status and clout, then you might be chasing PhDs. and you might be codependent to, you know, academic institutes to acknowledge you, to reward you, to, you know, give you a sense of worth. But if you were raised in, you know, in a different system where it was like, you know, the more drugs that you're selling on the street, the scarier you are, then you might really be giving your faith and loyalty to, okay, I'm going to be the rebel. I'm going to be the best, you know, drug dealer in the community. And so somebody that doesn't get that might say, well, this is really dysfunctional. But to that person, they have, you know, it's codependency. They have said, oh, this is how I get, you know, clout. This is how I feel worthy. This is how I feel that I have some self-agency in the world. But that's all, you know, the way I like to talk about it, or the way I sense about that, is that those ways of being have come to us from our states of survival, from a state of fawn, if you will. And, you know, we have disconnected. We have a fractured sense of self. We have a fractured connection with our inherent worth. And we are trying to, you know, it's codependency. We're trying to look outside of ourselves to figure out how we're going to do life. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't go very well, because we always feel deep down in our being that we're frauds. Mm-hmm. And we always feel deep down in our being that there's something not right. And the something not right often is that our intrinsic wisdom knows that we're not quite living our life from our authentic self. And that just doesn't feel good to us. As humans, that just doesn't feel good.
No, it feels horrible.
Does that, this make sense?
Of course. So for me, I was very oblivious to how little I felt about myself. You know, on a conscious level, I thought that I liked myself and loved myself, but my actions clearly showed otherwise. And the big thing for me, and I think what I'm seeing through doing this podcast, and part of the reason that I want to do this podcast, is that I think there's a lot of people out there who, like me, were never physically or sexually abused, right? Like, they didn't have it that bad. And so they don't really think that their issues are rooted in childhood trauma. And so it's like this whole concept that, like, you know, emotional neglect can be, you know, equally as damaging as some more, you know, horrendous forms of abuse and trauma. And so I'm assuming that that's something that you come across all the time, like through your work.
All right, shit show ladies. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels so much damn harder than normal and you can't figure out why? I already know the answer to that question is yes. And boy, have I definitely had more than my fair share of those days, and totally get just how frustrating this can be. But recently, I've learned that sometimes it's not just stress, lack of sleep, a dysregulated nervous system. It could also be my hormones at play. And that is where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Any shit show can do it. Just answer a few questions about what you've been going through and where you're at in life. After taking this quiz, you'll get personalized recommendations to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. So I took this hormone quiz myself. The quiz suggested that my body may be overloaded with estrogen, which is affecting me in all kinds of ways. And one of the recommendations that I got was to start taking Hormone Harmony, which helps with bloating, chronic fatigue, weight gain, mood swings, and more. And after adding it to my routine, I've definitely noticed a difference. Now, taking care of your hormones isn't just about feeling good right now. It's also about investing in our healing journey. And so by taking this quiz, you'll learn more about your hormone balance, which will allow you to start making small, intentional changes to support you on this healing journey. Whether it's the Hormone Harmony or another Happy Mammoth product, the quiz helps guide you towards solutions that work specifically for you. So if you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find out the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today. All right, Chicho. So if you're like me and you care about your skin, you want to have nice looking skin, perhaps you have sensitive skin, skin, but you don't want to fuss with or have the time for a 7-step skincare routine, then this one is for you. Le Pur Naturals Beef Tallow Face Cream, which I have been using for the past few months, and my skin has been thanking me. So this face cream is gentle, simple, and effective, made with real natural ingredients you can actually pronounce. No synthetic fillers, no chemicals you can't identify, just nutrient-rich beef tallow, pure essential oils, and beneficial ingredients like raw honey and vitamin E. It's one jar, one step, and you're done. Totally shit show proof. Perfect for anyone who wants healthy skin without the hassle. So if you're ready to unlock your natural glow and discover the power of nature's original skincare, then head on over to lepurenaturals.com/adultchild for 40% off. That is Lepure, L-A-P-U-R-E, naturals.com/adultchild for 40% off. Go get this great deal. Your face wants this. Your face needs this.
Now at Menards, save big money on everything for your next project. Shop our huge selection of concrete, from general purpose concrete to specialty sand and mortar mixes. We have what you need to get any job done right. View our entire selection online or in store today and save big money. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, what comes to mind as you ask the question is that, you know, someone that I had the privilege of working with, you know, or training with probably 30 years ago, Pia Melody, she really brought to light to me, you know, some of how to answer that question, which is that trauma, like one thing that always sticks with me, trauma happens whenever a child is forced to adapt to the needs of their major caretakers.
Mm.
And think of that. It's like in that process of adapting to the needs of the major caretaker, we lose connection with our truth, with our authentic self. We just do. I mean, the business of growing up has a lot to do with somebody's eyes being on you and saying, what do you think about that? Check in with you. What's happening inside? To trust you, to trust what feels right for you, to help that the child develop, you know, affect, you know, tolerance, to know, to help that child through the process of, you know, of challenges by checking in with themselves. But when a child is forced to adapt to the needs of the major caretakers, because the major caretakers just aren't there in that way, that, you know, and most parents aren't there in that way, not because they're, oh, you know, they're engaged in what we see as clear abuse. It's more like they're neglecting the child inadvertently because they're checked out trying to figure out how to be in the world themselves. And in that process, trauma happens. And trauma, you know, I want to just have, you know, I want to give, you know, credibility to like those in the field that have influenced or have supported my perspective. It's like a Bormate. It's like there's a fracture between you, the way you're being in the world, and your truth. Mm-hmm. Because your being in the world is really coming from your, let's just call it the codependency, your need to adapt, your need to figure out, what do they want from me? You know? And so then there's a feeling of like, well, I didn't, as you're saying, I didn't have it as bad as somebody else, but something really doesn't feel good within me. And the trauma is a fractured relationship with the way you're being and the way, you know, your authentic self. And we all know, even though we don't know, but there's a feeling like something's wrong because you're not, there's a fracture. There's the you that, you know, is here, you know, to evolve your competencies and your gifts and your intelligence, you know, and to offer something to the world. I mean, that's my point of view. And yet that's not where you're coming from. You're coming from the state of survival that you consciously or unconsciously assembled so that you could adapt to the needs of the world or the dominant culture or your family, whatever it is, and you know something's wrong. And usually those ways of being are often in extreme. They're like, you know, I really am influenced by internal family systems. Those attributes that you have within your own system are functioning in extreme ways to be okay in the world.
Yeah. So it's the survival mechanisms as well as the faulty core beliefs that we develop about ourselves.
We develop. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think of, if I, you know, I can add in here is that ILC really has been influenced, the birth of ILC, my understanding was really influenced by this little book by Don Miguel Ruiz, The Four Agreements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can look at what we're talking about from that, from the perspective of the Four Agreements, is that we make agreements unconsciously as we're trying to survive in this world. You know, the Toltec wisdom talks about it from, you know, the process of domestication. We then make agreements, and we make these agreements that form our adaptive roles, inform our adaptive roles, and have beliefs and have ways of thinking and have agreements. Like an agreement might be, you know, no one's ever going to love me. An agreement is don't trust anybody. An agreement will be, you know, everyone's a phony, or everyone's out to get me, or if only I was loved, or if only I was pretty enough, if only I was this enough, if only I got. So we make these agreements that, the way I experience it, get encoded literally in our system. Mm-hmm. And when we enter into the healing journey and we come back into, you know, connection with our inherent worth, and we recover what we've been giving our faith and loyalty to, we have an opportunity to re-examine the agreements that we made. So that's one way to look at it from, like, the Toltec wisdom from the Four Agreements. And another way to look at it is that we start to look at how trauma has happened as we have, you know, been forced to adapt to the needs of our major caretakers so that we can survive, because we need them to survive. We're interconnected. We're interdependent. We are tribal. We are not, you know, there's a lie that's been fed to us that we are, you know, like independent. Yeah. We're unique, but we're also collectively, you know, connected. Mm-hmm. And we need each other.
So obviously there's many healing modalities for treating complex trauma. How do you navigate with a client what is going to be the most effective path forward?
Yeah. So I'll say again that, or I'll reiterate it and maybe amplify a little bit of the way I see, you know, the process, the phases of treatment of trauma. And like I said earlier, it's like first is safety. Mm-hmm. That's first. And in that, you know, exchange with the client to establish safety, we learn a lot about their worldviews, their, you know, their cultural perspective, their cultural understanding of what the problem is, you know, quote unquote. We learn a lot. And in that process, we also want to invite clients to the healing journey in a way that resonates with their worldviews. And so earlier I said that there's many different modalities that perhaps serve to heal trauma. And yet I would say that there's like this one destination that's really critical, which is to reconnect with who you are, that's greater than your diagnosis, the parts that you have consciously or unconsciously developed, that you are greater than that. So in that, we would say that the destination is back to reestablish a connection with that, to consider that, to feel that. And, you know, then it's like the second stage is to like start to process it, but to process it from a state of safety. Mm-hmm. And then to process the next stage would be, how do you integrate that you are learning about yourself, the new agreements that you're making with yourself, the new patterns that you're developing in replacing those old ones. And, you know, how you get there with somebody. I mean, I think it's important to have a variety of ways to get there, because if we just think that there's one way to treat trauma, we are actually perpetuating the trauma experience of, mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you how to do it because mm-hmm. I'm the expert and you're not. Mm-hmm. So we really have to listen to the client's worldview, the client's language, their culture, all of that, to help them find a way that that resonates with them, so that they can find their path, they can find their way back, and then they can find a modality that helps them disentangle from those patterns. So it could be that psychodrama really is a way to help them disentangle from that. It could be that CBT, that is a way to help somebody, you know, with, you know, is that like looking at distorted, you know, mm-hmm. cognitions about themselves, mm-hmm. that might really work. I think what's unique to ILC, I want to say this, is that all of those modalities can be really useful. What I think needs to be added to any modality is the utter respect for the client's intrinsic wisdom that is available to them when they reconnect mm-hmm. with themselves. And that in of itself can be a process that takes time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Like it takes time. And so there's a lot of different modalities, but I think modalities that put the clinician
in the driver's seat.
The driver's seat is actually potentially harmful. It's perpetuating the idea that you don't know when somebody else does. Mm-hmm. And I think that is ultimately really disrespectful to the ethical law of life, that really speaks into how within all of us, there is magnificence that's available to us. There's something really, you know, like I think of the Hakomi method, that really speaks to how we all have an intrinsic wisdom within us that is self-directing, self-healing, and helps us unfold into wholeness. That is, you know, a really beautiful way of respecting the organicity of the human condition. You know, there's something there that allows us to really, you know, start to see and attune to, you know, that I keep on using the word magnificent because it's coming to mind. Is that there's something magnificent about it? There's within our system, you know, if you will, a pharmacy of possibilities to help us self heal.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to share some pivotal moments within your own healing journey?
Sure. I mean, that's a big question. I mean, there's many. Let me see where I want to start with that. You know, a memory that most often, you know, comes up for me when I'm asked that question is one of being a little girl, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old. And my family came from Cuba at a time where, you know, you were only allowed out of Cuba the Red Cross. You know, we weren't really, you know, Cubans weren't given permission to come into the United States, but in 1963, we got into the United States because my sister had a medical condition where she was, you know, diagnosed with glaucoma and that she would be going blind. So they gave us permission to come to, you know, through Miami and then to Massachusetts, to Boston, the Mass Eye and Ear Hospital to help her. And I remember being, you know, sent to, I guess we could call foster homes, you know, through the Red Cross, while my mother and my father would work, and my mother was with my sister, who was having, like, you know, surgeries after surgery to see if we could keep her from going blind. And when I would visit with my mother, I would, I didn't have the cognition to understand what I was doing, but I really kind of felt that I was generating love to her. And that might sound silly, but I remember vividly that I was probably 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. I was little, and she would, I could tell, it wasn't like I was thinking, oh, she's depressed. I could feel her sadness, and I just would send love to her. Mm-hmm. And later in my life, that, that I wasn't supported, if you will, back to my, my comment earlier that trauma happens whenever you have to force to the, mm-hmm. when you're forced to adapt to the needs of the major caretaker. It wasn't like I had anybody to say, teaching me, love is powerful, or, the energy of love is powerful, or you have something within you that is really, I want to just say to all of us, kind of practical, magical, we have this place inside of us, compassionate and loving, and it's like the wisdom of the heart. No one was telling me that. And eventually that felt quite vulnerable to be in that state, because I was a kind little girl that wanted to be loving to people. And, that unfolded into an extreme, way of being that looks in the mental health field as codependent. I took that way of being, if you will, and made it my winning formula, made it my, what rewarded me in my family of origin was to be the one that showed up and took care of. And, I'll just say another moment that really sticks out to me that later became moments where I had to reclaim my own sense of self and from a different perspective, right? When I got older, was that I had a mom who was really awesome, and she's passed. So I want to be respectful of sharing this, because she didn't mean to hurt me. But when she would say to me, "Don't be selfish. Mm. Your sister can't see." Mm. You can. So I, back to the agreements, I got agreements that don't be too much, don't be too important. Just you're the one that's here to help with, the trauma of that we're experiencing with your sister going blind, the risk of her going blind. So I became, very, like I said earlier, I became vigilant to where do I fit in here? Mm-hmm. How do I use what I've got? It's my natural attributes. And develop ways of being in the world. Now, was I thinking all that? No, of course not. But it was happening automatically. Back to the, the polyvagal theory. Our autonomic system is wired for safety and connection. So I was like, okay, I'll develop. It wasn't conscious, but I was developing ways of being. And those ways of being, again, looks quite codependent in the world. And so, I became very interested in trying to fix my family, really, and abandoned myself in many ways. And what mattered to me, like I think what matters to somebody who does drugs, is to try to get them to know how to process feelings. I mean, really, that's what I wanted. Like, I'm like, why can't my father stay in a conversation about my sister going blind? We need to process this. And he couldn't. So I was like, I want. So I became really, invested in my family's healing. But I didn't get too far with them.
Shocking.
I really didn't. It didn't go very well. In fact, they probably resented me for that role that I played. And at the same time, they, that was my role. They loved me for it, and they maybe resented me for it. Let's say that. And I, by accident, ended up in going to college for working with children or human services. I really didn't even know, 40 years ago, I didn't really know what psychotherapy was or counseling was. I came from a Latin family that was like, those are for crazy people. and, I started studying psychology at undergrad, and I started doing, had a dual kind of degree with counseling psychology, even though it was an undergrad degree, where I got to practice with a pretty amazing professor at Lesley, Dr. Neil Klein. And I got into, practicing counseling skills by helping, doing role plays where you would help somebody drop into their authentic self. I didn't know what that was 40 years ago. That seemed kind of like, this is kind of weird. And so that was a pivotal moment. I was like, wow, we can really help clients in this process called counseling and psychotherapy to befriend their truth. And that was 40 years ago. We didn't know about the polyvagal theory. And we did a lot of guided meditations and imagery to help clients like reconnect with themselves and get to know themselves. And so I became very curious about counseling. I also started to study codependency. And I said, well, I'm not going to be a codependent therapist. That doesn't sound good. So I will say humbly that what I was doing with my family that looked quite codependent, I was very committed 100% to not do it with my clients. Mm. So, you know, I didn't have, let's just say, the tone, the vagal tone to be with my family and stay, you know, out of their way and not being fawn. But I did develop it in the context of my role as a therapist. Mm. And I knew that it was disempowering to my clients, and it really lacked clinical integrity to be in that role with my clients where I am getting rewarded, my ego is getting rewarded mm-hmm. for their progress. So I said, well, it's not about me, it's about them, if that makes sense. And in that process, I really saw that what was, again, I'm going to use the word magical, but it wasn't like magical in a woo-woo way. It was like really beautiful to just sit with people and give them space to be. Mm. Let them be. Let them like share their story. Let them share their story in a way that invited a dialogue where they could like see beyond the story, to see that there was more to them than that story, that was a story that somehow they became attached to, but there were more than that story. And I didn't know what I was doing back then, but you know, what's really fascinating these days is that there's all this research that backs up that simply probably, what I was doing was we're going to reference again the polyvagal theory, I was attuning with mm-hmm. myself in such a way that I could get in ventral, mm-hmm. that I could get in the witness self in such a way that I co-regulated with the client. I allowed my nervous system to be regulated enough so that they could tune into their nervous system and not just identify as, you know, the victim of trauma. They were more than that. They were more than just their substance abuse diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And there's current research today that backs up that we really, like, I think of Dan Siegel's work of interpersonal neurobiology. You know, I'm a cell, you're a cell, and what happens between us is a social synapse. And I understood that. You know, I'm going to go back to when I was 4 years old and I was sitting with my mother and she was sad and depressed, and I would just send love to her. Well, I can translate that now today as a clinic, as a therapist, that what I was doing when I was in my 20s that I didn't know was listening with such impeccability that the client felt seen. Mm. And I wasn't trying to change them. I was trying to listen to what would make their life, what would make it different for them? What would change the game for them? And most of the time, what we found was that they had developed an attachment to addiction, like to substances. They had developed an attachment to thinking that if only they found the right guy or girl, that everything would be okay. And we'd listen with such, you know, like impeccability that you started to unpack that. And something happened. And it goes back to the Hakomi method. It goes back to, you know, when you really believe and with all in your bones that each one of us have intrinsic wisdom, you're seeing that, you're inviting that to show up. Mm. And something happens. People then start to self-heal and self-direct with your guidance, with your facilitation, but it's them. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't go very well when you're telling somebody to do something, because it's actually more of the same. Let me tell you what you need to do so that you're okay. And if you do what I say, then you're going to be okay. But then when that person, if that person really didn't feel it and wasn't moved to take action to change in that way, then when you're gone, they just go back to, you know, the piano analysis. They're back to, you know, not playing their instrument beautifully and organically the way that they're meant to.
Mm-hmm. So what about if somebody's, you know, looking for a therapist to help them with this? I mean, like, what are some good questions to ask to know if perhaps it's a right fit? Like, can you ask them? Have you, like, are you doing work? Like, how do you suss that out?
Well, that's such a great question. You know, I think the best question is to say, you know, how do you see the healing journey? Mm. How do you see it? You know, I appreciate your question because, you know, I kind of want to say, well, you know, maybe it's important to say, what have you done for your work? But, you know, maybe that's a boundary, you know, violation for.
Well, they could say no, they don't have to answer it. You could still ask.
But the question, I think, a very telling question is, how do you see the healing journey? You know, how do you see healing? How do you, like, if somebody says to me, like, I'll give you an example. If someone comes to my private practice, not even here at ILC or at ILC as well, you know, I want to go to treatment with somebody who is really trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, who, you know, takes that expert role, then that person has the right to go to that person, period. Because there's different people, we're all different. And, you know, I'd like to say that we really respect at ILC, and I certainly respect it in my work, the ethical law of life, which is this, you know, the right to be, become, and belong. Like, that's such an important piece of our that we need to understand in our clinical world, because somebody might want to go to a treatment facility that does CBT, that doesn't get into what I'm even talking about. That might be what they need. They might need Band-Aids. I respect that.
Mm.
So to me, what I would say to answer your question is that we first have to respect that not everybody might be looking for this way of this radical healing process that I'm kind of speaking into. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to ask questions when we go see a therapist. What kind of, you know, and what's the framework in which you work? What is the framework in which you see healing? What's the framework in which you see particular diagnosis? How do you understand addiction? How do you understand, you know, codependency? That's the first question. And does that, and my wish would be that you really listen, you know, but then again, that's part of the healing is like, we're not listening inside, we're listening outside.
Yeah, we don't know how to listen to the right answer.
Well, you know, I love what you just said, because we don't know how to listen in that way. Hopefully, if you go to the right kind of therapy, if you will, you know, someone's going to help you listen to that knowledge, to a silent knowledge that's within us.
Mm.
More than, because think of what I said earlier, trauma happens whenever we are forced to adapt to the needs of others. So we have been primed in our journey into this world to survive and to feel like we're part of. We have, like, what do they think I should do? So you go to somebody with a PhD, and they say, what you need is this, this, and this, and this, and this. And you're like, oh, okay. And you go to them. But, you know, your system knows this doesn't resonate with me, this doesn't feel good to me, but you keep on abandoning yourself and saying, well, they must know, they're the experts.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying about good therapy, good practice, best practice is that we help people say, listen, hide, make space. You know, I have a way of really experiencing this, and that when we inhale, we create this space within our being and we listen it. And that's, you know, connected to the ventral state. We take a breath, we create a ventral break when we're dysregulated. And when we breathe, we're also creating space to be with what's happening inside, to attune. And you go, this doesn't feel right to me. Huh? Let's investigate why that doesn't feel right. What's the story I'm telling myself? How is it maybe true for me? How is it not true to me? We have to listen. we're not trained to listen. We're not trained. We're not, I guess the word that I keep on saying groomed, but we're not guided to listen inside. In our need for safety and connection, we go outside of ourselves to get the answers, and we betray ourselves unknowingly over and over again. And then we wonder why our lives become unmanageable. Our life becomes unmanageable because we're not in the driver's seat. We're trying to control our external world so that we feel okay, because that's what we learn. We learn that if I adapt to your needs, I'll be okay. So imagine the healing process, as you've been sharing in your questions, that's been reflected in your questions, is challenging, because we have to come back home to ourselves and listen to ourselves. And we've been trained not to.
Well, this has fed my soul. This has been amazing.
You know, and I want to say that in some ways, you know, what I've shared could sound esoteric in some way, but what's really beautiful is that, you know, a lot of the scholars in the field, in the trauma field, have given credibility to something that I believe has been, you know, in our collective consciousness forever, which is that there is something within us that is, that offers intrinsic wisdom, that it is, that we have to be courageous enough in the mental health field to pause long enough to tune into that and to trust that again. Mm-hmm. And scholars like, you know, Dan Siegel, who offers us interpersonal neurobiology, really speaks to that. Gabor Mate speaks to that. Richard Schwartz with internal family systems, you know, the polyvagal theory that was offered to us by Dr. Stephen Porges, really are speaking into, you know, the science that we now understand that is so aligned with ancient wisdom that speaks to, like, there's something greater than the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are.
Thank you so much for your time. I love this.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.